I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Political institutions are roiling. Violent protests rock the streets over the treatment of minority groups. An unpopular war drags on overseas. All these scenes are as familiar now as they were back in the 1960s. Today we'll ask how the protests back then compare to our modern-day unrest, and whether people in current-day America are as engaged as the protesters of 50 years ago. Then biographer Walter Isaacson has chronicled Benjamin Franklin, Albert Einstein, and Steve Jobs. But for his latest project, he went way back to the Renaissance and Leonardo da Vinci. What revelations did he unearth about the great engineer and painter? We'll find out on Up to Date after this hour's news. Protests these days aren't what they used to be. Back in the 1960s, students, young people, and even some older folks protested all manner of issues. There were protests over civil rights, women's rights, gay rights, rights for students and workers, and protections for the environment. And hey, did I mention the Vietnam War? Protests happen these days too, but maybe not with the same frequency. Our guests for our first segment today have been comparing the protests of yesterday and today, and we're about to hear what they have to say about all this. With us are two professors from the UMKC History Department, Sandra Enrique. Sandra, welcome.
Hi, how are you?
Rebecca Davis is also here. Rebecca, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
If the level of activism in the 1960s was a 10 on a 10-point scale, what's the level of activism today, Sandra? Where would you put it?
I feel that currently maybe we're getting up there. I would say probably like at 7.5. There's activism happening everywhere around us, right? There's protests, there's marches. So I think that it's coming up on a rise.
So it's on the rise, you think? Yeah. What do you think, Rebecca?
Oh, I totally agree.
I mean,
levels of protest are, as you said, protests of the 1960s and today are different, but I would also say they're very much the same.
In what sense?
I think that they are the same in the fact that, I mean, first of all, protest is never popular. If they were popular, you wouldn't need protest to begin with. And what we're seeing is different perceptions of kind of the same ideas. I mean, if we go back and look at the Boston Tea Party, if you go back and look at the bonus marchers of veterans trying to get bonuses during the Great Depression, if you go and look at a very simple concept today of African-Americans believing that police officers shouldn't be killing unarmed black men. I mean, those seem to be very simple concepts. I mean, whether it's about taxation or violence or money from the government. So I guess when you say that they're the same and that they're different, I personally don't see that much difference.
It's interesting to me. It seems like, Sandra, that there's been this big gap that between the 60s and today, there were a lot of years in there where there weren't a whole lot of protests. Am I right about that?
Well, no, actually. You see a large period of time in the 1960s where that's where we think that's activism, right? That there's all these protests happening at that time. But a lot of the movements did not take off until the 1970s and the 1980s into the 90s. So, for example, if you think about, I do Latinx, Chicano, Mexican-American history.
Right.
And those movements don't start to pick up until the 1970s. So you have a large movement. You do have the movement with Cesar Chavez and the United Farm Workers starting off in 1965 with the first boycott. But a lot of that gains momentum well into the 70s. You also have, you know, Stonewall happening in 69 and then building up from that. And then to the 80s, if you want to continue with LGBT activism, you have, you know, ACT UP, even here in Kansas City, becoming very involved in the late 80s and into the 90s. You have people in the labor movement, who especially Latinx immigrants, who are becoming very involved in the late 1980s and into the 90s, even today. And finally, you know, immigration movements. If you look at Latinx immigration and immigrant rights, they have been there have been protests happening since the mid 90s adamantly until today with mm-hmm. DACA and the protection of DACA students.
I mean, Rebecca, if that's the case, why don't we think of the 1960s as this big hotbed of protests, but we don't think of the 70s and 80s as big hotbeds of protest? Why?
Oh, yeah, I think that's an interesting question. Sandra and I, when we were kind of getting ready to be on your program, we kind of created this timeline of different protests. And I mean, still, we had this idea of like, oh, it's about the 60s. But we really didn't see a spike in the protests just in our brainstorming until 1969. And then we get into the 70s and 80s. I think that the 60s has this kind of
aura.
Yeah, this aura, exactly. That was the word I was going to use about the period where, granted, there are lots of things coming together in really interesting ways in a short period of time. As you said in the introduction to our program, it's about LGBTQ rights. It's about women and African Americans and, I mean, Native Americans. And I mean, all of these things are coming together in a unique way, which I think that perhaps is different from what we see today, kind of that critical mass of different issues that are coming together. But I think there's just something about the 60s, and I don't really know what it is. Students, when I teach my 60s class, they will take classes on the 60s, but I could almost guarantee you if you advertise a class on the 70s, nobody would take it.
And TV was bad then. Everything was bad then.
Pet rocks and things in the 1970s.
Well, I always think I went to school at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and I arrived in the fall of 1975. And by then, all the protests and the intense activism, so much of it had just faded away, and the place was dead. And then a couple of years later, I remember seeing photographs of tear gas being tossed right across the street from where I was living, and I was like, "Oh my goodness!" You know, I always felt like I missed something, because when I got there, it was pretty quiet. Mm-hmm. And have you seen the same kind of thing?
Yeah, I think that there's this a misconception, right, about timelines, and I think that sometimes overlooking big movements kind of can cause this misrepresentation of the 70s. I think that the 70s also kind of gave rise to more local movements that are not necessarily in the national mainstream of civil rights, right? So you have people that are fighting for better housing rights. You have people that are still fighting for, you know, not having job discrimination within a local level. And the fact that it's so it's not divided, but people are kind of turning in to see what is happening in their local environments to bring change is what really drives this kind of disappearance, I guess, of civil rights movements at that time.
Mm-hmm. Rebecca, do you think there's a difference in perception in the way society looks at people who protest? Like in the 60s, again, I'm generalizing here, protesters were seen as radicals, whereas today, even some of my neighbors sometimes go down to the plaza to protest one thing or another, and maybe there's a difference there.
I would still say that protesters are still considered to be kind of troublemakers and agitators.
Yeah.
And, you can see that in the way that the media portrays, whether it is the protests that were taking place in Ferguson, the media made them into riots. Mm-hmm. And the media had, for example, did not make the stories of the NAACP coming into Ferguson and talking about how to peacefully protest Michael Brown's death, but instead mm-hmm. showed a Quick Trip on fire.
Right.
So, I think that the perceptions, yes, there are some people that will just go down to the plaza to protest, whether it's DACA or for marriage equality or things like that. But I would still say that overwhelmingly the perception of protesters is that you are kind of looking for trouble.
Looking for trouble. Okay, Rebecca Davis and Sandra Enriquez will be speaking at 6:30 Wednesday evening at the Central Library. That's the one at 14 West 10th Street downtown. Their talk, Standing Up and Sitting Down, Protests and Dissent in the 1960s and Beyond. Our phone number here, if you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888. Are protests today viewed differently than they were back in the 1960s? You can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Let's go to Al from Kansas City, Missouri. Al, good morning.
Wow, good morning. Having been at the original Love-In, having also been at the Pentagon with the demonstration, I'm looking back at this and I'm realizing that the 60s was the kind of the gestation of change, and it was a cultural movement that kind of paralleled China's cultural revolution as well. But the where things really took hold politically, other than civil rights, which kicked in heavily in the 60s, was the 70s. And there's this kind of candy coating about the 60s that, oh, that was the big revolutionary moment. But the reality was it was a late 60s and the whole 70s that really brought political pressure and change. And what I'm seeing now is that somehow people are written off, any demonstrations now are written off as kind of like an anachronism, kind of a throwback to something. And it isn't that. It's a type of activism that is seeded into our American consciousness. Hmm. And it just has to take a greater hold. And hopefully someone like Trump and these people will trigger a more profound result or active result. But, you know, it was the 60s that planted the seed, and it was the 70s that really took hold.
That's interesting. And Rebecca, that's pretty much what you're saying here, what you're agreeing with, Al.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, again, it just depends on what you call protest, mm-hmm. and how people perceive it. You can see some people that will support one type of protest because it's a group or a cause that they believe is just, but then will say, for example, that NFL players who kneel for the national anthem should be fired. And it just kind of depends on what the person's perception is as to what is real protest, what is practical, what is wise.
Yeah. What about social media, Sandra? I'm wondering how that changes the equation in terms of the ability to organize, because in theory, it should be a whole lot easier today than it was back then.
I have kind of been noticing how media has been playing a role in today's activism and protests. I think that it's a great tool to organize people. I mean, I think that one of the things that I was very impressed here locally was kind of a proactive rally for DACA once it was rescinded. And that was sent out on Facebook events, you know, kind of proactively just making sure that, you know, if it had happened, if it not had happened, there was going to be some sort of demonstration in support of DACA recipients and their families. So I think that it's a fantastic tool insofar as it brings you to kind of make sure that if you want to get involved, there's a way to do it. You mm-hmm. can go to a rally, you can engage in a boycott, or you can go to meetings. I think that like the ACLU and other local organizations here in Kansas City have had successful, you know, trainings and other events and lectures just to get people involved in the community. But I also think that media also plays a role in desensitizing what is happening. We are so overloaded with news every day, with mm-hmm. with different protests, with different instances that are happening that just desensitizes us. So, you know, we sometimes may be sharing all these political news that maybe some of our friends are no longer looking into, and they're tired of reading all of these different conflicts that are happening in our society today. And it kind of turns us away, needing, you know, a social media break. And so it plays two roles, right? Yes, it can and help us mobilize people. But at the same time, people may be getting an overload
That's
of information.
Because in the old days, they used to put little, you know, flyers on the poster boards in at University of Wisconsin-Madison, and there'd be hundreds of things. It was the same thing. It was too much information. But if you saw the one flyer about the protest coming up, that's how you would connect mm-hmm. with that kind of thing, you know. Back to some phone calls here. Let's go to Jim from Lee Summit. Jim, you're on Up to Date. We're talking about protests today versus the protesters of the 1960s. Good morning.
Good morning, and thank you for taking the call. Observation, I have been in a couple of protests. I'm 78, but I would suggest that all of us think about this for a second. In order to protest in a protest group or a march, there ought to be a test that you know what you're protesting about. I don't care the subject. There's so many people that are professional protesters that cause problems, and there's other people who do not have the right conception of what you're protesting about. Excellent example is somebody just mentioned DECA. I've got neighbors who are just all upset, and you ask them to explain it to you, and they can't explain it to you.
Yeah.
So you just got to have an informed, same thing voting. You got to have an informed population, or it just becomes radical.
So lots of information out there, Rebecca, but do people know what they're protesting sometimes? And this notion that Jim just threw out of professional protesters, is that legit? Are there really professional? You hear that sometimes.
Yes, I think that there are certainly professional protesters out there. And being, I would hope that before people show up at a protest and make their signs and things, that they know what they're talking about. And going to the point about media, I think that media makes it a lot easier for people to become informed. But I'm not talking about fake news or anything, but just there are so many different ways that people can become informed. They're not always doing it in the best way. In media has this impact of there's so much out there that you don't know what to pay attention to.
Right.
And it's also a lot easier to turn it off.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, before, if there were protests, I mean, if it was the March on Washington or the Selma March or whatever in the 60s, I mean, if you turned on the television, that's what you were watching.
Mm-hmm.
Where now, if you don't want to watch that, you can pick from any number of 575 other channels that you'd rather have.
Isn't that the truth? How about at the tactical level here, Sandra? I mean, are protests carried out differently today than they were back then?
I think that we're still engaging in the same various forms of protests that had been happening back in the day, right? So I mentioned boycotting, right? A lot of people are making sure that they're boycotting different companies or different products around in our country. You do have more direct action tactics that are being used, right? Like people sitting in, people kind of engaging with a more hands-on approach. Others are just showing support, right? Kind of showing up and being a presence at a rally.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, and obviously there's still, you know, the behind the scenes kind of activism that we don't see sometimes when, you know, people are coming into our country and said that, well, there's a Muslim ban or this is, we don't always look into who's in the background. Yeah, we had people show up at KCI, you know, with signs and kind of being a presence and being there for support, but we don't see the lawyers, right? The people that are working in the legal background that are also doing a fantastic job, and you know they're in the behind the scenes. We don't see those faces. So much like in today, right? We do have the same, well, not the same, but in a way, a more evolved way to seeing different ways of protest. There's not just one way of doing protest.
Yeah.
There's not just one way of being active.
That's interesting. What about the Trump effect here, Rebecca? I mean, maybe the elephant in the room here. We have a president who's proving to be controversial, to say the least. Is it to what extent is he stirring the pot and almost encouraging people to come out and protest what he's doing?
Well, I think as a historian, I mean, we like to look back. We don't like to look as much to the present day and making judgments and things. I think it'll be very interesting to look 50 years from now how it is that we are judging President Trump and his responses. In terms of stirring the pot, we have a president that likes Twitter a lot, and that in an age where lots of people like Twitter, it's easy in those little kind of 140 character
bursts.
Yes.
Yeah.
He has a way that sometimes it seems like he likes to stir the pot. He likes to get people to kind of push back.
Yeah.
And again, I think it'll be interesting for us to look back and kind of juxtapose him to other administrations. So
Paul from Kansas City, Missouri has a question about professional protesters. Paul, good morning.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. The implication of a professional protester, it seemed to me, is that somebody who has a vested interest, a very narrow invested interest in protesting, where it's actually, a livelihood. And that seems to me that's what the original comment was that the other caller made. Sort of applied, and it was sort of validated by your guest. And I would like some, a little bit more clarification on that.
Do people get paid?
What exactly is meant by professional protester?
Sandra?
Yeah, I would say someone that is very invested. There's invested protesters. They're oftentimes people don't get paid. They don't get paid to protest. There's people that have been involved in certain causes that just feel that that's their livelihood, that's their work, right?
And but do some special interest groups actually pay people to go from city to city to protest? Do we know that?
I am not aware of that. So.
Yeah, I'm not aware of that either.
Yeah.
I mean, it depends on that definition of what makes you a professional. Mm-hmm. I think that, and this is just my point of view, if someone said, oh, well, that person's a professional protester, that comes with some kind of stigma
right.
towards it. I would argue that Martin Luther King was a professional protester.
There you go.
So, yeah. And at the time, he was looked down upon for that. I mean, the FBI was going after him, and there's lots of evidence of, I mean, people called him a communist, people called him all kinds of things.
Right.
But I mean, it depends on what that definition is. Did Martin Luther King get paid to sit in a Birmingham jail and write that letter? No. But, I mean, that became his livelihood. I mean, mm-hmm. he made all the different talks and things that he went and the visits. I would say that he fits into what I would call a professional protester of the 1960s. But he's one of the great American heroes today.
How did you guys get interested in the politics and the history of protests?
Well, I am from a border town of El Paso, Texas. And I came across the fact that, you know, there's about 80% of the population is Mexican-American or Latinx, and my history was not in the textbooks. And so for me, my desire to learn more about my history and my border community was what drove me to learning more about El Paso and its Mexican-American community there. And so then from there, I started working with the community, kind of looking into the preservation of communities, and I kind of learned the different ways that the community had become active in preserving their community for over 100 years. And mm-hmm. that's what drove me into looking at civil rights and our different meanings of activism, because El Paso's movement, even though El Paso, Texas, is an important battleground for the Chicano movement, mm-hmm. Our historic studies don't mention otherwise, right? It's always L.A., it's always Chicago, it's, you know, San Antonio, but not El Paso. And so that always drove me to look into how do people protest, how are people active, and how does it differ from other people? And then, you know, you have to situate your work within a broader scope, and that's what got me here.
Rebecca Davis and Sandra Enriquez will be speaking at 6:30 Wednesday evening at the Central Library, 14 West 10th Street, downtown. Their talk, Standing Up and Sitting Down, Protests and Dissent in the 1960s and Beyond. Thank you both for a good conversation. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you very much, Steve.
You bet. Time for a break. When we come back, we'll visit with Walter Isaacson about his much-praised new biography of the great Leonardo da Vinci. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. On Friday's show, we spoke with Lamont McIntyre, a Wyandotte County man now free after serving 23 years in prison for a crime he didn't commit. You can find that conversation at kcur.org. Tomorrow, former press secretary and KC native Josh Earnest talks about his time in the Obama White House. Also, a discussion on sexual harassment and the Me Too hashtag campaign. Well, when he reached age 30, Leonardo da Vinci sought a job. When he listed his skills, it was his work as an engineer that came first. He could design bridges and waterways and cannons in public buildings. But then, oh yeah, he could also paint. The man who would go on to create two of the most iconic paintings in history, The Last Supper and the Mona Lisa, thought of himself as a man who could do a lot of other things as well, in science and engineering. All of that begins to speak of just what an amazing man da Vinci was, and it speaks to why Walter Isaacson picked him for another of his biographies. Isaacson's new book is titled simply Leonardo da Vinci. Walter Isaacson will be in town Friday night. He joins us now from Voice Tracks West in Los Angeles. And Walter, welcome back to the show. Nice to have you.
It's nice to be back, and I can't wait till Friday night to be back in Kansas City, one of my favorite cities.
Oh, that's great.
I had all sorts of aunts and uncles from Kansas City. We used to go there every summer.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Well, Da Vinci died 500 years ago. Did he ever come to realize in his own lifetime just what a tremendous painter he was?
Yes, but he always thought of himself as a combination of an engineer and a painter, which is why I liked writing about him. He blurred the distinction between art and science. And nowadays, when we're raising our kids or organizing our universities or even our lives, we tend to put things in the silos. We tend to stress specialization. And when Leonardo was doing something that he felt was beautiful, either as a work of engineering or of science or of art or of architecture, to him it was sort of the same brushstrokes that created patterns of nature. So he knew he was a great painter. Most of his life he yearned to be known as a great engineer as well.
You know, I was just floored, speaking of the painting, you know, reading that in working on the Mona Lisa, he worked on it for so many years that he carried that painting around with him from town to town, maybe even on the back of a mule. I mean, really, Walter?
Well, you know, he didn't like to give things up. He didn't finish a lot of his paintings. He certainly didn't deliver many of his paintings because he always thought there was a way to improve them. For example, on the Mona Lisa, he was dissecting the human eye during that period from 1503 when he starts the painting until the end of his life. And he realized that light that comes directly into the eye and hits the center of the retina sees detail, and those that come in a little bit from the corner of the eye sees shadows. And so when he does the smile, the details of the smile, the tiny little dots at the edge of the lips, don't really turn up much, but the shadows do. And that means the smile flickers. When you're looking directly at it, it's a little bit harder to see it. But when your eyes wander, she starts smiling at you. Hmm. It makes it interactive. And those are the types of really cool things he was doing as he carried the Mona Lisa around with him for the last 16 years of his life.
I was going to say, you talked about the eyes, but he also spent a lot of time dissecting facial muscles, trying to understand how they worked. And he'd worked on cadavers and peeled back skin and looked at that musculature, if you will. What did he learn about working on cadavers that helped him paint that smile?
Well, he learned every single muscle that touches the lips from the face. And things that you and I could learn if we had just paid attention, like Leonardo, and been more observant, which is, say, that the bottom lip, your lip, is a muscle, and it can move separately. The top lip is not really a muscle on its own, so it's more controlled by the movement of the bottom lip or other muscles. And so if you go around trying to stick out your top lip, you can't, but you can stick out your bottom lip if you try. Now, that seems pretty mundane, but he has about 20 pages of every muscle, every nerve in the human face. And on one of those pages, in a light piece of chalk, he starts drawing the smile. Hmm. And you see the Mona Lisa smile starting to form. Some writers about Leonardo said he wasted all this time on anatomy. I'm going, no, the Mona Lisa would answer that criticism with a smile. It's not, you never get a smile like that unless you know everything you can possibly know.
He also, you know, spent so much time layering paint, layer of paint upon layer of paint in creating that particular painting. And you even talk in the book about the way he used pigment and his motive for painting her to begin with. Tell us about the way he used pigment.
He loved using oil glaze paints with very, very light pigment. So, for example, on the Mona Lisa, he does a white primer coat on the piece of wood. It's painted on wood, not canvas. And then layer after layer of just the tiniest brush strokes made of glaze, which is sort of oil with very little pigment in it. And what happens is the light goes through the different layers, hits the primer coat, and the light sort of bounces back. So depending on the angle of your view and where the light is coming from, it looks translucent, the painting, even from the inside. These are all the optics and science, and for that matter, observational skills that Leonardo brings to this party.
You know, my appreciation for what Da Vinci did here just grew enormously from reading that one chapter on that painting. I had no idea, Walter.
Well, you know, Leonardo continues to fascinate us because he's not like Einstein, who has a certain mathematical genius that you and I could never, ever accomplish. Everything Leonardo did came from being ridiculously curious about things and very observant. so he could observe how light goes through a translucent layer of paint. He also spent a lot of time observing, which you and I could do, how the expressions on a human face reflect the emotions they're having, how their outward gestures reflect their emotion. You know, the Last Supper, every one of the apostles is doing gestures, having facial expressions. It's almost like a dramatic scene because they're going one after the other, and each of their expressions sort of then affects the person, the apostle next to them, after Jesus has said, "One of you shall betray me." And that comes from walking around Florence when he was a kid with a notebook attached to his belt, looking at people talking in the plaza and doing sketches of what their facial expressions were and then some notes about what he thought they were feeling inside. That's what we do when we understand people well, when we're paying attention. Leonardo just did it much more, you know, fervently and excitedly than we do. And I think we can learn from him how to be more observant about people's emotions.
Walter Isaacson will be speaking about Leonardo da Vinci at 7 Friday evening at Unity Temple on the Plaza. More information, rainydaybooks.com, or call 913-384-3126. You said that the big surprise in doing this book is what a joyful person Leonardo was. Describe him to us, and in what sense was he just a blast to hang around?
He had a lot of friends, unlike Michelangelo, who is in Florence at around the same time, who was a bit of a loner.
I'll say a very different personality, yeah.
Totally different personality. Leonardo was somewhat flamboyant. He dressed in, you know, purple clothes, and his tunics were shorter than average. Very, very good looking, and always exercised. He was known as being well-proportioned, you know, by people of the time because he was muscular and tall, had very long, curly hair. You know that drawing, Vitruvian Man, the guy standing,
yes,
spread eagle in the circle in the square?
Yeah.
That's basically a self-portrait of Leonardo. Those are his flowing curls. That's his face. That's his body. And his friends, whether he's in Milan or in Florence, the two places he lives most of the time, you know, he's got a best friend, you know, Donato Bramante, who's an architect, and Luca Pacioli, who's a mathematician, and Leonardo does the drawings for Pacioli's book. And, you know, I could name 40 people who are in Leonardo's notebooks of my friend, and he usually uses a nickname. I need to ask him what it was like being in Holland and how people walk on the ice in Holland. Just everything he wanted to ask people who were his friends. And then great dinner parties. He talks about he had a companion he took to one dinner party who spilled wine, and he was just joking about that's when they were all trying to draw a Vitruvian Man because they were doing it together. So one of the things I learned from this book is that creativity is a team sport. You know, collaboration is key to innovation. And we sometimes think of a Leonardo, you know, in a garret up in a castle somewhere, painting. But no, he was out and about in the streets, having dinners, having dinner parties, and bringing the smartest people together, or, more fortunately, being at the Medici palaces in Florence or the Duke of Milan's castle in Milan, where the court gathered everybody from playwrights and poets to mathematicians and architects.
You know, you just finished this book on Steve Jobs, you know, who's almost a contemporary, and now you've gone back and looked at the life of a man who died 500 years ago this year. And I'm wondering, what was the singular challenge about going back and trying to reconstruct this life from so many centuries ago?
Well, it's amusing because with Steve Jobs, I would talk to him every day, you know, when we were working on the book. And he would describe to me exactly the shape of the original iPod and how he did the curves. On the other hand, with Leonardo, there's something amazing. There's more than 7,000 pages of his notebook.
Yeah, I was going to say.
And no other biographers base it, you know, or people who write about Leonardo, they tend to write about his 19 or so paintings that, you know, are finished. I wanted to combine the science, the engineering, the curiosity, the to-do list that he has every day of things he wants. Like, You know, why is the sky blue? Why do people yawn? What does the tongue of a woodpecker look like?
Yes.
All of these things are in his notebook. And you're going, wow, that's so cool to keep notebooks like that. So day by day we can, and paper was a little expensive, so he would cram on one piece of paper sketches of people he might put in the Last Supper, and then a mathematical challenge like squaring the circle, and then a way of doing light as it hits a curved surface, all on the same page. And so you see a mind dancing with nature, with rhyme, if not reason, across the page. And that was more exciting because with a contemporary figure, you can interview them, but you don't have the daily notes that they may take. And it's one piece of advice I'd give listeners is, you know, take notes, make lists on paper in a notebook, because 50 years from now, your grandkids are going to get to see it, just like 500 years after Leonardo, we get to see his notebooks.
So you left one hanging here, Walter. Why did Leonardo want to know about the tongue of a woodpecker?
You know, I laughed when I saw that the first time. Describe the tongue of the woodpecker. And, you know, I'd say, oh, that's ridiculous. How would you even figure out what it is? You know, grab a woodpecker and open the mouth? And it's in the notebook a couple of times. And not to spoil my book, but the very last two paragraphs in my book, I pause and I say, the tongue of the woodpecker is like three times longer than the beak. And it wraps around the brain when it's not in use to protect, you know, the brain. When the woodpecker hits a piece of wood at 10 times what would kill a human, there's no reason you need to know that. There's no reason Leonardo needed to know that. But I thought, you know, since Leonardo wanted to know, you might want to know just out of curiosity, pure curiosity.
Yeah.
And that, to me, is a two-word description of the joy of Leonardo, is pure curiosity. That helps you see the patterns of nature. That helps you understand how we stand in the circle and the square of the earth and the universe and are connected to creation. And that's why the Mona Lisa smiles.
Walter Isaacson is my guest. His new book, Leonardo da Vinci. You've written these towering biographies of Steve Jobs, of Einstein, of Benjamin Franklin, and now of Leonardo. If you could only pick one, who would you want to spend a day with?
Well, the most pleasant person to hang with would be Benjamin Franklin. You know, he's just a very inventive person. And Leonardo. I mean, these are the two people who like other people, who are the friendliest, who like bringing people together. They're very similar in a way. Leonardo is, you know, 10 times, as even Franklin would admit, 10 times greater and more interesting and more artistic and more talented than Benjamin Franklin. But they both bring together people. Franklin called it his Leather Apron Club, and, you know, Leonardo had the Academy that he brought people together. They both love everything. They both love, for example, whirlwinds and swirls of air. When Ben Franklin did the Postal Service up and down the coast of America, he'd ride his horse and he'd see a whirlwind. He'd get inside and measure how it swirled. That helped him discover the Gulf Stream. You see that in Leonardo, too. Whenever he saw swirls of water going into a bowl or water flowing into a pond and causing swirls, he looked and observed those swirls, and you see him in the curls of hair he paints. You see him in the heart valve drawings that he does in his anatomy. So he, Ben Franklin and Leonardo, are two peas in a pod. They're both love, you know, socializing and picking people's brains and having great conversation. So if I had to pick one, I guess I'd pick Leonardo now.
Yeah.
But don't make me pick one. I'd do Ben Franklin and Leonardo together. I'd split the check.
What did he regard, Leonardo, what did he regard as his greatest achievement?
I think that he knew by the end of his life that the Mona Lisa was a culmination of all of the art, all of the spirituality, and all of the science and anatomy and feel for the geographic, geological ages. He kept it, he started it in 1503. It's a cloth merchant's wife named Lisa. The cloth merchant never got that painting. As you said earlier, Leonardo lugged it around Italy and then finally across the Alps to France where he dies. It's by his bed when he dies. And every year, he's just trying to do an extra little perfect brushstroke for it. even though he really, in the end of his life, he was still trying to design the ideal city, a new castle, new ways of using water to help do the sewerage of a new city, all these engineering feats, hydraulic feats. I think by the end he knew that 500 years later, the main thing we'd remember is that Mona Lisa and the Last Supper and the paintings he did.
You know, a different Leonardo DiCaprio has already optioned your book. When can we expect the movie? Do you have any idea?
I'm not very good at understanding how Hollywood works. I don't come from that. I am in Los Angeles today. I'll ask around. I think Mr. DiCaprio is a perfect choice because I don't really know him well, but I know that he cares about nature. He cares about the environment. He cares about science. He also cares a lot about the visual arts. You know, he collects art. And then the performing arts. One of the things I learned from Leonardo's notebooks is that Leonardo, early in his career, did pageants and plays for the Medici family and then the Duke of Milan. He loved theater and stage productions. And so I think a Leonardo DiCaprio has a feel for every aspect of Leonardo da Vinci's life. So I was very glad, but I read it in the papers when I found out that Mr. DiCaprio's company had optioned the rights to it.
Walter Isaacson's new book, Leonardo da Vinci. Walter will be speaking at 7 o'clock Friday evening at Unity Temple on the Plaza. More information, rainydaybooks.com. Walter, it's always great to have you here. Good luck with the book. A tremendous achievement. Sure appreciate
and
it.
And I love being at Unity Temple on the Plaza. I've done it, I think, for each one of my books, and Kansas City is just such a wonderful place. Thanks for having me.
It is. Thanks, Walter. The big sports news this weekend for college basketball fans was the revival of the KU-MU Border Showdown. It's been 5 years since the Tigers faced off against the Jayhawks in men's basketball, and this weekend's game raised almost $2 million for victims of recent hurricanes. Here to give us a lowdown on the game is sports contributor Greg Eklund. And Greg, welcome back.
Glad to be here, Steve.
So how big a deal was this, really? Put it in perspective for us.
Well, I could go two ways. One, I don't think it'll be like a painting that 500 years later, it'll be remembered.
Really?
This game will be remembered because let's put this in the perspective that this is a game in late October. It's a game that doesn't count. Yet it raises almost $2 million for the victims of a hurricane.
It's a great idea.
It was a great idea because people are very passionate on each side of the line. Take into account in late November, Kansas City is considered the college basketball capital in this country, and we have the College Basketball Hall of Fame here. And later in November, we have a great basketball tournament that takes place down at Sprint Center. With four teams that come in for two nights of back-to-back college basketball games, a doubleheader each night. That game and that doubleheader each night won't come close to what yesterday's game drew as far as interest and impact and everything, all the aura surrounding the game. There'll be four nice teams that come in for that, but it won't come close to matching the KUMU basketball.
I was going to say, my colleague at the Star suggested on Twitter yesterday, why not a tournament every year featuring KUMU, Creighton, and Wichita State?
Yeah.
Now, that would be interesting.
That would be really interesting.
The question everybody wants an answer to, though, is this weekend's game a prelude to a regular season showdown between KU and Mizzou?
And the answer is not foreseeable. And it's mainly because the ball, it takes two to tango in this, and KU is the party that really doesn't want to for
because
its own reasons.
Still upset that MU bolted the Big 12, or
apparently, and there's a grudge on that. Even though we've talked about this before, the past schools that have also defected are Colorado and Nebraska. Yet KU puts them on their non-conference schedule these days, and doesn't put MU. So it's deeper than that. This is the border rivalry, and there are still hard feelings about it. Though, it was 5 years ago since they since they defected to the Southeastern Conference, and you would think by now that some of those wounds have healed by now.
Well, it strikes me as a little silly, but fans in both states want to see this matchup happen regularly, right? I mean, there's no question about that.
And I ask the hoteliers and the restaurant owners around the Power and Light District if they'd like to see this.
No kidding. You
would get a resounding affirmative on that.
Let's switch gears here and let's talk about NASCAR. See what I did there? I'm a witty host here. The Hollywood Casino 400 was held yesterday at the Kansas Speedway. You say this year's race took on a local flavor. I'm wondering why.
Well, Martin Truex Jr. was the winner in the race, and he was the winner also in the spring at Kansas Speedway. So he's the first driver to win both races in 1 year at Kansas Speedway. But the sponsor of the car is Bass Pro. And Bass Pro is owned by Johnny Morris, who is based in Springfield. And Johnny Morris is a huge economic impact with what he does in and around the Springfield area. And it really goes beyond the Springfield area. It goes regionally. And I had a chance to talk to him after the race yesterday. He considers Kansas Speedway his home track. And so Carl Edwards, who's from Columbia, is no longer in the sport. He retired. Clint Bowyer is not even in the playoffs. He's beginning to fade as a driver. I mean, we'll find out in the coming years if he's in the waning portion of his career. But right now, if there's any local race star on the scene at NASCAR around here, it's Johnny Morris because of his backing of a very successful race team.
So Truex has these two wins at Kansas Speedway. What does that say about his luck for the rest of the series?
Well, he's had seven wins this year, and in NASCAR, if you're a seven-time winner in one season, considering how competitive the races are, that's a big deal. He's leading in points, but with the way the playoff structure is entailed in NASCAR, if he dropped out early, like if he had an early crash in next week's race at Martinsville, he might not have a chance to compete in the playoff championship in Homestead, Florida at the end of the year.
What role do sponsorships play in NASCAR? How big a deal is that?
It's a huge deal. It's really what drives the sport. If you associate in the history of the sport, the big-time drivers like Richard Petty, you always associate Richard Petty with STP. Or if you think about Jeff Gordon, he's also always associated with DuPont, which in this case was the product behind auto body painting. And I mean, there's that natural association between a driver and a sponsor if it's successful.
Just quickly, lots more empty seats this weekend out there, though.
There were. It was a week later than last year. That may have been a factor, but NASCAR is going through the same thing that we've talked about in golf. It's in a transition period. I talked about Carl Edwards, who has retired. Gordon has retired. Tony Stewart has retired. You have changing personalities in the sport.
And finally, the Chiefs family learned of a big loss to their community this weekend. Who was that?
That was Bob Springer, a big-time and top-notch professional as the PR director of the Chiefs when they were not very good. This was before the Carl Peterson era. John Makovic had one playoff team during that era, but no matter how bad the Chiefs were at that time, Bob Springer was top-notch and treated the media with dignity and class.
That's Greg Eklund. Greg, thanks very much.
You're welcome, Steve.
On tomorrow's show, former press secretary and KC native Josh Earnest, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Justin Garnett produced this show. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.